Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Today, I've got friend of the show, Lucas Vaz, joining us to discuss his new fund. It's called Ravelin Capital, and he's investing in a really interesting sector that's deeply relevant to The Realignment's focus on geopolitics and the state of the United States. He is investing in critical software. This means using software, the internet, and technology to address real-world problems in everything from space to infrastructure to manufacturing and, of course, defense. It's also great to talk with Lucas because he's just launched this fund, so focusing on what it's like to someone from our generational cohort to address these issues from the perspective of venture is incredibly interesting, as Silicon Valley finds itself in an interesting transition point from the 2010s to the more serious 2020s. If you enjoy Lucas's thoughts, you should definitely check out his new fund's website. That's linked in the show notes where you could also find some of his writing as well. A huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Lucas Vaz, welcome to The Realignment.
Excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm pumped to chat with you. I almost said welcome back to The Realignment, but I realized we spoke on The Deep End, my old On Deck podcast, and I did an in-person panel with you in Miami, but these were not technically Realignment Enterprises. So I'm pumped to chat with you here. So how about you just quickly introduce yourself to the audience, noting, of course, you've got an announcement that you announced a few weeks ago. We've launched a new fund and you're building in this critical software category.
Yeah. So, basically, long story short, I'm an immigrant. I've loved this country since I was a kid. I told my parents when I was 12 years old that I wanted to come and find a way to build a life in the United States and never go back. And that's what I did. I mean, in many ways, like, that's my life story. Came to America, went to school here, married an American girl. And I've been in venture for the last 5 or 6 years. I love investing. I would say in many ways, my real passions are things like geopolitics and history, as it relates to America and the West. And I've been thinking about these spaces for a really long time. And during this time, I've been very fortunate to really find investment opportunities as it relates to these sectors, which I think would not have been possible 15 years ago. Through this work, I've been fortunate to have been, very early investors in companies like Apex, Traba, Hadrian, and a lot of other great companies in the space. And then as of 6 months ago, I started my own firm. I just announced the firm, Ravelin, last week. So it's been an exciting time.
Yeah, that's why I'm pumped to chat with you. I love your deep interest in institutional decay, infrastructure, geopolitics. I like chatting with an investor like you because I think for a lot of folks who are interested in these topics, it's easy just to get frustrated or feels that the political system doesn't really provide you any opportunities to work on things. And if there's something that investors actually can and are doing in the case of you, it's like, okay, put your money or put other people's money where your mouth is and actually invest in companies trying to address these spaces. So here's where I would like to start. I feel like everyone kind of has their own term to describe this amorphous space we're describing. So obviously A16Z has American dynamism. I know everyone and their cousin wishes they came up with that first. There's frontier tech, there's deep tech, there's hard tech. You, though, very specifically say you're investing in critical software. What does that umbrella term mean when it comes to this space and your thesis about how you should act in it?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say, look, the quickest way to define critical software is just software first companies building critical industries. Critical industries, largest industries by GDP that have traditionally not been touched by technology. Things like manufacturing, industrials, energy, national security, construction, et cetera, et cetera. All of those industries that have been relegated by all of the progress of technology that happened in the last like 10, 20 years. I would say the companies that I generally like to work with fall in two buckets. One is companies that are straight up software companies that are building for these sectors, right? You can think of companies like First Resonance, Epsilon 3, Integrate, that are all very good examples of that bucket. The second bucket are companies that are, touching the real world, right? Like companies that may be hardware or hardware first even, but that have an element of software to them that is just fundamental to how they exist. I think Anduril with Lattice is a great example of that. I mean, people don't talk about it enough, but SpaceX built all of its own software, right? Like there's a great story of software to be told about SpaceX itself. And I would say like all of the big companies that we think as of hard tech or deep tech companies, I would argue that like the big ones or the best ones, like they all have a story of around why software is just core to the business, right? Hadrian is a great example of that, and there are many, many others. So yeah, that's kind of a quick 60 seconds on what I do.
Yeah, and I think folks are going to be curious about some of these company names, especially if they're not in this growing but definitely niche category. So two examples of companies that I'm deeply aware of that you've mentioned are Apex and Hadrian. Can you explain what these two companies, what the companies are, what the space they're covering actually is, and how software meets the real world and the way they're applying their actual plans?
Yeah, I mean, look, Apex is a spacecraft manufacturing company building satellite buses, right? So you what when you usually like the mental picture that you have when you think of satellites, you're usually thinking of the satellite bus. There's a satellite bus, and then there's a payload that goes inside the satellite. The satellite bus industry is a giant industry that's only getting bigger. I think we're in the early innings of the exponential growth of the satellite business, a satellite bus industry. That is very weird. Everything is just custom build, highly specced, costs a ton of money. It's a very opaque process, and what Apex is doing is kind of flipping the industry upside down, and saying, hey, like actually, like we're gonna come out, stand the right price, and stand the right buses, which is a crazy idea for the industry. And just saying, hey, like, if you want a bus, you can go on a website, you can buy a bus. You can actually buy a bus on Twitter. If you go on the Apex on the Apex account, you can see that their bus is listed there. And Hadrian basically aims to integrate like top verticalize the supply chain for national security for aerospace and defense, which is an industry where the suppliers for companies like SpaceX, Anduril, we're talking about like 60,000 mom and pop shops that are spread out across the country. Those people are all aging because we have not done a good job of like replacing the manufacturing workforce. So these people are going out of business. And these are the businesses that are supplying the most vital parts for all of these industries. So and if you look at both of the companies, and the founders would be able to speak to it in a 100x better way than I ever could. They all think about software as being central to their business, or that are basically creating doing parts of the job that will be able to help scale the company, that will help to bring down costs, that will help to do all these sort of things that the traditional companies that came before them would not have been able to do.
Awesome. And something I like to always think about, so much of my thinking around the tech industry is structured around Marc Andreessen's Software is Eating the World essay that came out in 2011 in the Wall Street Journal. And it focused on the opportunity that startups had in the 2010s in the wake of mobile computing with the iPhone, especially, and a lot of the interest and shift towards the tech industry that came after the 2008 financial crisis. So famously, it talked about how software was going to eat the taxi industry and eat hotels, all those different categories that people have very much experienced in their own personal lives. You said at the beginning of this episode, though, that if we look at these critical industries, everything from infrastructure to manufacturing, these deep tech, hard tech, critical software, American dynamism categories, pick whichever category you wish, they were not eaten by software. So if you're launching a fund now in this particularly, like, it's a difficult time both to like raise a fund, but also deploy a fund, what do you think has changed to create an opportunity, which is obviously different than actual success? Why is there now an opportunity for software to eat these industries that have been previously untouched?
First of all, like in many ways, what I'm doing and others in my place are doing is just build on the shoulder of giants, right? The reality is that like A6Z, all these other funds, they started, they told the story that started that really changed the venture industry over the last like 20 to 30 years. Look, I don't want to speak for Marc Andreessen, but I think that his thesis was in many ways correct. I think what happened is just that I would argue that like if we look at like the early 2010s, we just went after as an industry, as a tech industry, we went after a lot of the low-hanging fruits. And now we're actually going to, some deep strategic problems. I don't buy the meme that SaaS is dead. I think that there's a lot of people in these sectors that are just like, oh, software companies suck, or like, SaaS companies are terrible. I don't think that's true. And I think that, some folks will end up paying a price for that, unfortunately. But I do believe that a lot of areas, when software went to eat the world 10 years ago, and you look at a lot of areas, and I don't want to speak of specifics, but they're just extremely saturated, right? So I think the most areas of traditional software are at this point extremely saturated. And we're finally seeing a new wave of entrepreneur that is like, wait a second, like, let me do something different, right? Like, I don't need to start like, the 150th company like building in this space. Like all of that will get competed away pretty quickly. Let me start something that for one, people were not looking at it up until a few years ago, but two, I would argue has actually the potential to create the biggest returns. This is, I think, this is a point like worth going deeper on, because if you look at all the biggest companies on the planet, I'm talking about Apple, I'm talking about Tesla, like these companies were built on the foundation of thinking how to merge software and hardware together. How can we build something that is truly unique at this intersection of software and hardware? And the companies that have executed on this, they're the most defensible companies. They're the biggest companies by market cap. They're the companies that have most impacted the world. So that's another reason in my mind why these categories are so exciting. Like the wins that we're talking about here, historically, I would argue they have been some of the biggest wins in the history of capitalism.
I'd like to try a bit of some thoughts that have been percolating out on you. So I have the privilege of working in a bunch of different spaces at once. So I have an academic career. I also have a DC think tank career, and obviously like work in the tech industry, like where we met via OnDeck. And what I've kind of come to find is there's kind of a gap in the way that I think a lot of VCs and technologists think about our present moment, especially when it comes to war and like geopolitics. So for example, when the Houthi rebels started launching drones and missiles at the US fleet in near Yemen, you had a bunch of VCs tweeting, going on podcasts, talking about how like, look, like we've just seen the future. We see that the aircraft carrier or the battleship, well, not battleships technically, but ships that people associate with that term are under threat. And the US just like can't keep up. And we really need to invest deeply in technology and all these different things to like rebalance this reality. So we see that on one hand. And those events then obviously caused a bunch of people to write all these like essays in this category. On the other hand, you look at the war in Ukraine, and obviously drones are there. There's all this technology, but if you look at what's happening to the Ukrainians right now, it's not that the Russians have sent an overwhelming number of drones across the Ukrainian front lines and are forcing them back. It's that the Russians are literally just sending thousands and thousands and thousands of bodies and thousands and thousands and thousands of rounds of artillery into those Ukrainian lines. And the Ukrainians can't recruit enough soldiers, and then also can't produce enough artillery, and then neither can the broader West. So we're in this weird quasi-World War I moment where we could kind of see the future, right? Like the tank comes out during World War I. The tank is really going to matter in World War II. But I would kind of think of like AI and remote warfare as being the equivalent of the tank in 2017, there are going to be these like ultra specific circumstances where it's going to be game changing in a specific battle. But the ultimate bigger question is one more traditional: mass, manpower, artillery. I would just love to think about this because I love thinking and talking with you, because you are also not just thinking about the tech hype part of this, but you're also interested in geopolitics. So I just love to hear like your thoughts around like the dilemma of like this past, present, future dynamic where we have to position ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, look, first of all, like I'm not an expert in war. I'm not an expert of, you know, what's happening in Ukraine specifically. But I do have a lot of thoughts on this. And I think what you're saying reminds me of a lot of what I wrote on this essay manifesto, whatever you call it, that you can find on my website. And in some ways, what you're getting after touches on, you know, kind of the second part of the essay that I talk about, you know, like these weapons for rebels, and just this question as to why so much talent has flown into the tech industry over the last 30 years. And my conclusion there, and I'll just keep this brief because you can find it on the website, is just that, look, like, whether you like it or not, all of the world's best talent, or I would say like most of the world's best talent, right? 70-80% plus has gone into the tech industry over the last 30 years. It's just a fact. Unfortunately, we see all around us, right? Like the collapse of our institutions, the decay of our infrastructure. And kind of my conclusion on the essay is like, look, like the only way forward is through, like, we're not going to be like, we just can't turn back the clock, right? Like we can't go back to the 1950s and just say, oh, you know, like we're going to get all of our best people to work in the government, which is what people did back then. I don't know, we can't just turn back time, and I don't know how to get to a world where like all of the world's best people are going to be excited to work in the government, to be an academic, to work in all these institutions. It's just a reality. I'm just telling you, as I see the world out there, that all of the world's best talent is in these tech industries. Now, where I do agree with you is that it's not enough. I am doing my job as a venture capitalist. I'm dedicating my life to this, that I think that, for one, most important, this is the best way to make money is to actually to invest in these industries. But two, that I think that if we have companies that succeed in these areas, we can actually move the needle in all of those sectors. That being said, I will also acknowledge, to your point, I think the Russia example is a great one, that it's not enough. Like, just building software, building companies, building this hardware software companies, I think would really help. It would really move the needle. But I'm also an institutionalist in the sense that I don't believe that we can just like fully replace all of these institutions. Like we need to find a way to reform them. And there's just, you know, basic facts around the globe, as you mentioned, you know, like just people, body mass, that still matter, right? It doesn't matter how many startups we create. It doesn't matter how much technology we build. Technology alone is not the answer to all of our problems. Let me put it that way.
Well, and this is why I really want folks to zoom in on your reference to critical software as being the key here. Because like the whole point of the anecdote I opened you with there was just that when you're a technologist or a venture capitalist or a software engineer looking at these challenging industries where, like to your point, it's critical, I think it's very easy to engage in quasi science fiction. It's easy to get excited about the idea of like, okay, wow, if we could just, people talk about this in the context of Taiwan, like, wow, if we could live in, because I've seen very serious VCs tweet this, wow, there could be a world where rather than put US sailors, airmen, Marine soldiers at risk over Taiwan, like we could have like a drone ship and you could just have 50,000 drones repel, deter a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. I think vision is really exciting in the same way that if you're Billy Mitchell and it's the 1920s, he's trying to get the army, because the Air Force used to be part of the army, excited about the idea of like, hey, wow, like these airplanes, even though they're only 20 years old, they can eventually sink battleships. And that has major consequences for how World War II played out, because obviously the aircraft carrier and its ability to deploy aircraft around the globe ended up mattering far more than the giant 19th century battleship that people thought was so key at the time. So I'm just trying to get people in tech who are excited about this space. And obviously it's most easiest and most obvious to get excited about drones and remote warfare and AI and all those different categories. But where I'm interested in, and I think this is where your investment in Hadrian really matters, I'm interested in, okay, so in a world where artillery and ammunition and manufacturing is actually key, where can software get us back to where we need to be? We can't just snap our fingers and make it be 1940s America again, where you have Detroit just running in all cylinders. So, okay, like, to what degree can software and technology ramp up our efforts? I loved your point you said earlier about how, like, look, here's a problem we have. SVA, I think, is very good at this. 60,000 suppliers, boomer retirements, silent gen retirements, the businesses aren't getting passed on. How do we find ways to replicate that existing infrastructure in a way that allows us to defend ourselves? So I just think that you've really done a great job of actually zooming in on the actual hinge points beyond just the exciting science fiction.
Well, listen, I appreciate it. And like, let me just make the point that, yeah, like, to a large degree, I reject the kind of blind optimism or indefinite optimism, if you will, that I think most of the tech industry has embraced, right? It's just idea of like, hey,
can,
like,
you explain, because folks might not have read 0 to 1, explain that the optimism quadrangle, I think, is the way to do it.
Well, yeah, Peter Thiel elaborated on this almost 20 years ago that you know, most of the tech world, there's versions of indefinite optimism, which basically, you know, basically means that, you know, the world is just going to get better. You know, we're just seeing all of these massively positive trends, and you don't need to do anything about it. Like, the world is going to get better by itself.
Ride the wave.
And, ride the wave. And it's just incredibly self-defeating, because if you believe that the world's going to get better, you know, through no work of your own, you're not incentivized to actually do anything to actually push the needle. Definite optimism is in some ways the inverse of that. That's saying, hey, like, the world's actually going to get better, but you have a play, like, you have agency, and therefore, like, it's your duty to actually move the needle and work on these things. And ditto for indefinite pessimism. The tech world, certainly, I think, to a very large extent, just by its diversion of, you know, indefinite optimism, or, you know, just blind optimism that everything's getting better, you know, everything, there's a new hype every day, right? Like, we transition from cycles to cycles. And the reality is, and this is unpopular to say, but it's mostly a cope, right? It's like, we need to believe in those things because it helps us go through the day. It helps justify our time. It helps justify, you know, the jobs and careers that we take in, and it's just very dangerous, right? So to go back to your point, ultimately, like, I reject this version of like just this blind optimism that we tend to have as a tech industry, but I'm also optimistic that we can solve these problems. I'm optimistic that like through the work of like incredible entrepreneurs that are dedicating their lives to these industries, we can fix these big, hairy, scary issues, and maintain America in the West, you know, on the top of the world, and have another American century.
No, I think that's well said. So, you know, in this, you know, last section here, or two last sections. So one, I enjoyed your essay. I'll link it in the show notes. Folks should check it out. But I appreciated how you've really rooted a lot of your approach here and just thinking you've done over the past 5 years, which I think, conveniently enough, this is why you and I are simpatico. I started the realignment 5 years ago because I also was thinking through a lot of these big themes. I just noticed a lot of people, 2016 happens, Trump comes in, not to get all political. Very clearly, everyone's like, okay, things are kind of different now. You take a few years, you start percolating. And then 2019, I really, especially because it was before COVID, folks start saying, okay, like, let's start like moving forward on this. So you identified three areas where you started thinking seriously about 5 years ago: decaying infrastructure, collapsing institutions, and changing geopolitical tides. I would just love to hear, especially since you also podcasted like during your VC journey, Solarpunk, great podcast. We shouted out your co-host, Ian Cinnamon, who is now leading Apex. So like shout out to him. I'm glad he found something more of a podcast to do with his time. But I'd just love for you to talk through the past 5 years in broad scopes, 2019 to hear your thought process.
The industries have changed massively, right? I mean, just the level of interest, not only from VCs, but also I think most importantly from founders, it has grown exponentially over the last 5 years. To your point, I wanted to address something on your previous question, which is, as much as I agree, like, look, like, just having a bunch of like tech people like change this industry is just probably not going to be enough. Like we need to have we need to find ways to repair our institutions. We need to find ways to like flow incredible talent through them. That being said, like look, like I think it's a massive service to the world if we can get like really young, ambitious talent to want to start like these incredibly ambitious companies as opposed to starting, the 50th dog walking app, right? Like that, in my mind, like that's just definitionally a good thing. And as I reflect on the last 5 years, I would say like through the service of like people like Catherine Boyle, Trey Stevens, Palmer Luckey, like and Elon Musk, of course. I just see like a generation of people, not just like young people, but people who, spent many years like maybe perhaps like doing other things. And now just say, wait a second, like I need to take a step back. I should really dedicate my life to this. I believe I can move the needle, or at the very least, it will be like a much, much more like worthy and exciting way to spend my life. And yeah, I think because of all of those reasons, and I would say finally, because of, we're all building, like I said, in the shoulder of giants, right? Like because of companies like Palantir, because of companies like SpaceX, because of companies like Anduril, we're seeing just a massive flow of talent and capital into these spaces that is unlike anything we've ever seen before. So it goes back to the optimism thing. It's a look like I'm not blindly optimistic that these problems will all solve themselves. But just looking at what's happening on the ground right now, it's impossible to not be very optimistic.
I love the way you frame this in generational terms because, as you know, because you've been in these spaces for a while, a lot of folks took really seriously the mid-2010s critique that, oh man, like the brightest minds of our generation went to go work on advertising tech. Because if it's 2012, like the smartest thing you could do career-wise is go work at Facebook pre-IPO. That's a real move you should do. If people should read Antonio Garcia Martinez's previous realignment guest book, Chaos Monkeys, on this phenomenon. Just really just extrapolates what it felt like to be a guy like him who like started out focusing on Wall Street. Okay, the industry interest shifts. Now he's going to Silicon Valley and he's taking all of his like really, really smart focus and focusing on optimizing ad targeting rates. So that's an interesting thing there. I think what happened in our generational cohort, and obviously, I think Gen Xers and even some baby boomers were affected by this too. So this is more just like a, it matters what point in life you are rather than do you have to be a brilliant millennial or Gen Z to perceive this. What really happened was the past few years just made so clear how limited we are by the real world still, in the sense that, wow, there actually are huge supply chain issues. Wow, actually, if there were to be a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, that would fundamentally, I think, in many ways, ruin our lives in ways that are just separate from a confident belief that things are just going to keep moving the way they were moving. It really did feel, this has become a cliche at this point, but it really is true. If it's the year 2013, you and I are talking about our careers in tech, it really would just feel that it's kind of the end of history, man. Like, things are pretty good, right? To quote President Obama during his inauguration, like, we're the nation of Facebook and Google. So, like, okay, in that environment, go make your tech money. Go build the 10th dog walking app. That's, maybe it doesn't work out, but maybe you'll get a convenient like a little exit and get acqui-hired by PetSmart whenever they build their app, right? But it's just so hard, I think, to, if you're like a serious person interested in these ideas, it's way harder to make those trade-offs now. So I just appreciated the generational way because I just noticed this when I talked to founders and like some VCs in our category about this.
Yeah, I mean, look, I appreciate it. And I think this is a little bit of a cliche, so I don't want to spend that much time on it, but I think the war in Ukraine, COVID, all of those things were just massive, massive awakening moments, or a realignment, if you will, for a lot of these people that I think just looked around and said, like, holy shit, like, things are not going as well as I thought. Or, just said it had like some degree of awareness of just their own mortality. I think with COVID, and this happened to a lot of people that just said, you know what, like, my time is finite, and every day matters, and this is not really how I should be spending my time. Like, there is a worthy cause. Like, there is something that is greater than myself, and if and therefore I should really work towards that.
So here is basically the closing section. I am fascinated by venture capital firms, funds, etc., at an institutional level. So like you're launching this, so a couple of things. A, you're launching this firm at like a difficult time in the industry. People are shutting down, people are starting up, some people are going back to like bigger firms. So I'm interested in like your just thoughts on what it's like to launch a firm, a fund in like this environment. But then two, thinking back to a16z, my wife works there. We've had a lot of a16z guests on. I think about, okay, they launched the firm after 2008, and at the firm, like writing's huge, right? So like Ben and Mark are writing a lot. They launched the a16z podcast, like really like turn it into like a serious media effort. You obviously kicked off your firm by writing. Hopefully you could be convinced to relaunch some form of a podcast because you were really, really good at it and it was super cool. I guess my question to you would be like, what is just like your thesis separate from critical software about why, how, and format when it comes to a venture firm in the year 2024?
First and foremost, like, building a venture firm, being my own boss, it has always been my dream. I think that I was very fortunate, in many ways, to have a clarity, at a very young age that, like, hey, like, this is really what I want to be spending my whole life, with, if I have the privilege of doing so, and I don't want to do anything else. And in many ways, it was hard for me to just grapple with, that realization, and how profound and lucky I was in many ways to have that, at a young age. So in many ways, that's why I did it. But second, I do think, like I said, there's a massive opportunity in these sectors. There is still, I would argue, like, not a lot of people doing these kind of deals at the very early stages. I think we have a lot of players on the multi-stage side. We even have like some firms that raised a ton, a lot of money for like big seed and Series A funds coming after these sectors. But the initial $1 million, the initial, like, $2 million, you sometimes still see amazing entrepreneurs, like struggling to raise that money. I would say, like, just to your point, about a16z, and I have a world of respect for them. There's just many ways to be successful in venture, and I think it's very easy, and perhaps like this was one of the hardest things for me to kind of accept and internalize over the last couple of years. It's very easy to just look around and say, oh wow, like, they're doing this. Oh wow, like, that firm I really respect is doing that. As opposed to asking the question of, like, why is that the right thing to do for them? And I think that for me, like, as I build Ravelin, and to be clear, I don't have answers to all of those questions yet. I think the one thing that is my North Star, the one thing that I care about the most, is, like, I'm really in this to hopefully, build a firm that's gonna last the next, like, 3 decades, 4 decades, my whole career. And I just want to be very careful to not build my own prison, which I think is surprisingly easy to do, in this industry. Like, you have like these little shiny objects in front of you, so you want to raise a little bit more money because you're gonna get that, or you're gonna create a platform team because that way that's gonna lock some things for you, et cetera, et cetera. And then you end up realizing, 10 to 15 years later, that you actually hate your job. That's kind of how I think about it. Is like, I don't have all the answers yet, but that's kind of the the thought process or intentionality that I bring to answering those questions.
Yeah, I love that. And I think my takeaway from what you just articulated here is I really do think, and I brought up A16Z not just to, shout out half of the family household income here, but also just point out that the firm launched after the 2008 financial crisis, which is a really interesting historical hinge point. The same way launching a firm after the, tech bubble in 2001 was very interesting too. We're now in the wake of the post-COVID vibe shift. So, and I think in many ways, we're going to think of the history. And I think if you're successful and if you like constructing your own prison, I love that. I think folks should, everyone should bookmark that at a career level on 15 different levels. I think people are going to think about how this worked in the context of when you launched it. So I just love the idea that like in a moment, like during a moment like this, it's helpful not just to think what is everyone else doing and how do I kind of like fit their playbook into like my own story, and instead just be like intellectually open and honest to A, not knowing the answer quite right now, but B, things going a bunch of different directions. So this is super great. Can you just shout out as we close out the firm's website and where folks should go to learn more?
Yeah, it's just ravelingcap.com. If you're a founder building those spaces, I would always love to meet you. Reach out anytime at lucas@ravelingcap.com.
Thanks for joining me, Lucas. This has been great.
My pleasure.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.